welcome to Inside Education. My name is Sean Delaney. Coming up in today's programme, we will have a live in studio John Heffernan, who is a project officer in the National Centre for Technology and Education and a member of the executive of the Computer Education Society of Ireland. John is also a qualified history teacher, and I'm going to talk to John about the current state of play about ICTs in education. But first, we go to education news with Barry Hennessy. How are you today, Barry?
Very good, Sean. Thank you.
Barry, the Tánaiste was on home turf this week, setting out her vision for education in the coming months and years.
Well, for 30 years now, the McGill Summer School in Glentees in County Donegal has become the venue where politicians, academics, business leaders and commentators go in late July when they want to drop a word in the ear of the nation. Now, this year's event proved no different, and on Thursday it was the turn of the Tánaiste and Minister for Education and Skills, Mary Coughlan, who is, of course, also a local TD for the area. And she took the podium as part of a broader debate on education policy. Now, if those who'd made the trip up to Donegal were hoping to hear a significant announcement, they weren't going to leave disappointed, as the Minister outlined at length her belief that better arrangements for the induction and probation of newly qualified teachers at both primary and post-primary level are required. Now, listeners may recall that back in May, the ASGI President Joe Moran called for a specific induction year for newly qualified post-primary teachers. Indeed, Mary Coughlan was actually in attendance at that ASGI event, although she didn't speak at it. Well, now, Mary Coughlan has set out her stall regarding the arrangements she wishes to put in place to support and assess newly qualified teachers in their first year in the job. From September 2012, the Minister proposes that the Teaching Council will take responsibility for the induction and probation of all new teachers. In the interim, an induction support programme is to be put in place for all primary teachers qualifying from September of this year, with similar arrangements following early in the academic year, this coming academic year, for newly qualified post-primary teachers. Now, all this will involve attendance at courses outside of school time. It won't be compulsory for teachers to attend those courses, though, and already the INTO has criticised the expectation that teachers will attend in their own time. Now, whilst probation by the Inspectorate of the Department of Education and Skills has always been a fact of life for primary teachers, the process of post-primary has always been more informal. Indeed, as Minister Coughlan herself pointed out this week, it's often been more of an administrative sign-off by the principal without any actual classroom observation. Given the tiny number of post-primary teachers who secure permanent employment immediately upon qualification, most teachers regard being reappointed for a second year as proof that their probation has gone according to plan. Now, elsewhere in her address to the McGill Summer School, Minister Coughlan spoke at length about the need for reform in higher education, confirming that the long-awaited Hunt report will be coming through that Marlborough Street letterbox in the coming weeks. Referring to the fact that the participation rate in higher education here has now reached 60%, the Tánaiste said that future higher education policy must focus on supporting a range of institutions catering for a very diverse cohort of learners. Mary Coughlan said that the consolidation of institutions is required to achieve critical mass, and that clustering of diverse institutions in each region, focusing on clear routes for transfer and progression within regions, is necessary. Now, on research, the Minister said that with so much public money now being invested into research activity, and obviously you'll recall that last week here we dealt at some length with the Cycle 5 of the PRTLI funding, that was an investment of close on $300 million in research activity in the universities. Well, the Minister says that with so much public funding now going into research activity, there has to be an eventual purpose and destination for research ideas. Research, as she put it, cannot be simply for research's sake. Well, as I mentioned already, Dr. Colin Hunt's report on the future of higher education will be sent to Minister Coughlan shortly, and already leaks have suggested that the report will come out strongly in favour of a return to fees at third level, something that the current programme for government has ruled out. Gathered in Galway this week, student leaders decided to get their retaliation in first. Gary Redmond, the USI president, said that any return to fees, or indeed a graduate tax, would act as a major barrier to higher education. The USI, its president said, would stand by Ireland's current and prospective students in fighting for their right to a free education. So as I say, it was all happening in Glenteith this week, and it looks as if we're going to have the Hunt report before too long. Sean, I imagine we'll be devoting plenty of time to analysis of same, but that is this week's Education News.
Okay, that's great, Barry. Thank you very much for that. And Barry, you're going to stay with us today while we talk to our guest in studio. So if you want to join in, you're more than welcome. You're tuned to Inside Education on 103.2 Dublin City FM. Podcasts of previous programmes can be downloaded from iTunes or from our website, which is www.insideed.com. Now we welcome to the studio John Heffernan. John is a qualified history teacher, an active tweeter and project officer for the Technology and Integration Initiative at the National Centre for Technology and Education. John is also a member of the executive of the Computer Education Society of Ireland, and he is the only Irish teacher attending the upcoming Google Teacher Academy, which is happening next week. John is therefore well placed to talk about the integration of technology in our schools. So you're welcome to the studio, John.
Thanks, Sean.
John, we spoke to your colleague on the Computer Education Society of Ireland executive, Adrian Webb, earlier this year prior to the annual conference. How did the conference go?
The conference went pretty well. We had an increased numbers on last year. We had about 220 people this year that attended. The conference itself consists of a full day with kind of multiple sessions running at the same time, so there's something for everybody. We had a number of different keynotes, Joe Dale being the most well-known, who is a fairly well-known ICT and education private consultant now, but he's a former teacher of modern foreign languages, and if you're interested in modern foreign languages, Joe is a person that you'd want to listen to.
Okay, and I also read an article that the CESI wrote for In Touch earlier this year, and there were a few things that you mentioned that I wasn't that sure of. I'd heard a little bit about them, but Second Life in education, what exactly is that?
Second Life is a virtual reality environment, a virtual environment where you create your own avatar and you have full kind of 360 degree access. Like, it's like pretty much like a computer game that people have played.
An avatar is an image that stands for yourself.
Yeah, exactly. So you actually can't name yourself your own avatar, so basically you have to give yourself a predominant nickname or something on it. So it's got great potential, but it's been around for a couple of years, but it hasn't made the break. There has been movements to create an open sim environment where it'll be more open source, and to get more kind of people interested in doing it or using it on a more regular basis, because it's still kind of behind a paid firewall and there is a lot of sex and pornography in certain parts of it, so there is that whole issue to be concerned about. So the open sim idea is trying to get more of a general person user to get involved on it.
Okay, so you go in there then as you take on this identity. Where is the educational application in all of that?
The best example I've seen when a history teacher's hat is a recreation of a Roman village. So basically you have kind of other people who are dressed up as, say, a centurion or a slave. So by interacting in that environment, you're actually dealing with people who are playing a persona on whatever character that you're playing. So it's the buildings are realistic, and the people there are usually well informed of what we're trying to do. I think that particular one came from a university's project that they actually set their postgrads off to create a virtual world based on what they'd learned. So for example, if you're doing Pompeii and you're using Second Life, like the ability to have to go in and use people that are actually playing a role will make it far more realistic than actually looking at a textbook.
So I suppose one way of thinking about it is that it's an online form of role play, is that right?
It can be. And another example has been where they have used it to bring people from different parts of the world on an online conference where you can actually bring in video, sound, and actually have people there virtually from all around the world. So you can actually have a conference on a particular topic with loads of people from around the world. It's pretty much a third level tool rather than a primary tool or second level tool, but it has potential, but again, it comes down to people using it in the correct way.
Okay, so I suppose when you talk about the second use of it there, I'm thinking there about that being an application that teachers could use if they could actually all meet together.
Exactly.
in that forum. But then the other one would be where you're kind of doing the more role play. That might be for younger, maybe for post-primary or for, as you say, third students in third level.
Yeah.
Okay.
There's interesting possibilities with it. But again, it comes down to that the issue of kind of Second Life is like there's people there having virtual sex and things. But it's just that there is islands where you can kind of restrict people access to it. So it's but a case that people can move off and end up in places where they wouldn't necessarily want to. So that's probably the biggest drawback. But the Open Sim project is designed to be more open for education than what Second Life is.
And why would that be different then, say, than setting up a conference call with Skype or something like that, or having, you know, conversation, a more general conversation?
You could create a particular scenario, like in a particular building or a particular place, that you can't physically do with people around the world. So if you want them to engage in a virtual physical artifact, you can do it on Second Life rather than do it with a Skype call.
And another thing that was talked about at your conference in Port Leash this year was Crazy Talk. What's that?
Crazy Talk is a great piece of software. Basically what Crazy Talk can do is, best example I can give you is take a picture of, say, a circle person like, say, Port Pierce. You can use the software to actually change his lips you could actually have a tracking with a sound file. So basically, if somebody's speaking a speech from Warwick Pierce and have his lips move. So for certain people, with special needs, I know in one particular case that they've actually have taken a photograph of the person and then let them talk and record what they want to say and then edit their picture to virtually say what they're saying, but they don't have the confidence to stand up in front of an audience to do it. So they can actually have this avatar going, or this picture going, of themselves speaking in their own voice, but the lips are doing all the work.
So it's almost like a high-tech kind of a puppet.
Yeah, that'd be a good way of examining it.
Okay.
Explaining it.
Now, your day job, John, is at the National Centre for Technology and Education. What exactly is that National Centre?
The NCTE is the agency that deals with the integration of technology, namely computers and the internet in schools. So we would run the school's broadband network. We would provide advice and software, hardware. We also run SchoolNet, which is a portal site for content for primary and post-primary schools. We also are involved in CPD as well, so we would organise a lot of courses with ICT in education related topics.
Yeah, John, Barry Hennessy. John, I suppose last week on the news roundup, we learned that only about 2% of schools in the country have access to high-speed broadband. This came out in a parliamentary answer from Fergus O'Dowd. And it seems to me that one of the big obstacles to, you know, using IT the way, you know, to the extent that women want, is that there is not still a huge degree of variability between the IT infrastructure from school to school. I mean, what's your overall picture of how equipped schools are to fully take advantage of the online offering at this stage?
The 78 schools that are part of this pilot, that they're like 10% of the second level schools. But the idea is that these will become hubs themselves to support local schools in their area. Like the infrastructure, from speaking about technology here, is that it's coming in from the HNet backbone, internet backbone. So where those schools will be linking into a HNet provider, and then those schools themselves will then act as a provider to other schools in the area. So it is a pilot project, and down the line there will be more schools coming on stream with 100 meg broadband. Like there is loads of resources for schools to use online, and having 100 meg broadband coming to your school will really make it very useful to use those technologies. But there is a whole area where of areas of training and infrastructure in schools needs to be kind of considered first.
One of the things you were mentioning in a few moments ago, we were talking about major applications such as Second Life, and obviously the concern that, okay, there are aspects of it that you certainly wouldn't bring into the classroom. Am I correct in saying that the Department of Education has blocked YouTube nationwide, that you can't, if you're using a connection that comes from them, you can't access YouTube? Is that correct?
It is, but it's going to change. At the moment, there's two filters. There's an A and B filter, and YouTube will be blocked on both. We're rolling out a 7-level filter for the schools. So on, I think, 2 of the filter levels, YouTube will be allowed on it.
Yeah,
so
it seems to be, you were mentioning about modern languages earlier on, it's my own area in the day job, and there's so much on there that you can't access in school. And it's just, it seems a crying shame that hasn't been put in place before now.
But even though that's true, Barry, at the same time, though, there are certain packages, John, if I'm right, on this, where you can actually download a YouTube video to your own computer and then use it in the classroom.
Yeah. There's always ways around problems.
Mm. And can you think of any of the sites where that can be done? Is there Zamzar or something like that?
Zamzar is a file converter site, but there's a site called kickyoutube.com. That will allow you to download YouTube videos from there.
So even if it is blocked in your school, you can actually get access to some of the good videos.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like to anybody that's interested in solving that problem, they'll find a way of getting around it.
like most IT problems. The Technology Integration Initiative, that's your area, John, that's what you've been working on. What kind of progress has been made on that initiative to date? I mean, I know what you're saying, it's a pilot initiative and it's involved 10% of schools, but, you know, how successful has it been, do you think?
It's always going to be a work in progress. Like, over the past number of years, like, a lot of work has gone into putting kind of a higher speed broadband in schools. Like, some schools are in kind of areas where they have very bad connectivity, and over time that will change. The main focus as well we've been looking at is on the area of purchasing. Prime schools this year got grant funding to buy ICT hardware equipment, and the NCT organised procurement frameworks to make it easier for schools to buy that equipment. So instead of having the headache of going and trying to find five local suppliers, we had a national process that we would be able to make schools get five quotes quite easy from the main suppliers, dealing with them directly.
Okay. John, your own background is as a teacher is in the area of history, and I wonder, could we go on to that, and could you say a little bit about what good uses of technology you have seen in that subject of teaching history? And I presume it's post-primary you're going to start with anyway. Now, you've touched on it a little bit already, but what have you seen that you think is a worthwhile application of technology to history?
There's loads of resources for history teachers out there. A lot of museums now and libraries are putting content up online, like the National Library of Ireland have put up some very interesting content in the past couple of years on 1916 and William Butler Yeats. The use of technology, like from podcasts where you have different companies or different programs like yourselves have a podcast, companies and programs have put content up to make it easier for students to access that, and listening to history podcasts, for example, is a very good way of reinforcing a lot of points that you're making in your classroom.
And I suppose also you can have more access now to source documents, and students even in secondary school or even primary school can now act the way that only researchers could have had up to now.
At the moment, like Google are doing a major book scanning project, and they're beginning to kind of roll out to a lot of different areas, like where a lot more primary source material is becoming available online. Prior to becoming a teacher, the last company I worked for was involved with putting the Oireachtas debates online, and being a history teacher working in an IT company, doing that was quite interesting because you'd be turning around to your workmates saying, did you believe that Michael Collins said this in the Treaty of Debates, and the rest of the guys are trying to get the work done. And so eventually I was moved off that project because it was taking too long getting my work done. But like even in the UK, like the British Archives have the resources now to for any schools to have any particular interest area to send them the content in the PDF, and it is actually amazing now what access you have compared to even when I was in school. But again, it comes down to teachers being able to use the technology and kind of have the vision to take in the content that they have out there, which is probably might be even harder problems to solve sometimes than actually the physical getting access to the content.
And our web quests, are they still used, or have you come across web quests at all?
Not recently.
Okay, yeah, that's what I was thinking, because I mean, that used to be a nice way to create projects online. You know, it was good, say, when you were actually putting it up, but also if you could access other people's projects then, you know. But they just didn't seem to catch on as well as I thought they would, anyway.
Yeah, I am aware of a teacher in UK that's trying to organise a kind of an internet scavenger hunt to tie in following the Second World War. He has a plan for 3 or 4 years down the line on D-Day, the day before D-Day, to actually have a French or a British registration send out messages that would correspond to the messages that were sent out by the BBC to the French Resistance. So basically, students are going to have to be online, and they're going to have to search and try and find these little nuggets to solve a kind of a quest really online. He's at the early stages of it, and I think that is a fantastic idea for history teachers to move in on. At the moment, he isn't willing to share that outside of his own school, but I think over the next couple of years, it'll get to a stage that'll be very interesting to kind of be able to use technology like that. Like you'd be listening to a French radio station to find out a clue for a project or something like that.
Okay, one of the things that's become very popular in recent years is blogs. But do you know to what extent are schools using blogs, and more particularly, how are schools using them, as opposed to individual teachers? But are schools actually using them in their work?
The NCT rolled out a WordPress platform for schools. We've called it Skullnet Blogging. So schools
Skullnet Blogging.
Yes, Skullnet Blogging.
Yeah.
To enable schools to get their own blog. They can use it as a standalone website, or they can use it as a kind of a school blog. From a school's point of view, the most obvious use is to have it as a portal of information for the whole community, whether it be parents, other agencies in the community, to be able to find out what's happening in schools. I know a number of schools during the bad weather in December were putting messages up in the blog to say that school is open or school is going to be closed. So it was a very useful resource for schools to use to kind of inform a lot of people in a very short space of time. They're also using it within the classroom as well. Like, you see a lot of primary schools doing news days, stories, taking pictures of the local area, put them up. So it's a great online resource, and it takes out the need to actually know how to taking out the need of knowing HTML to actually create an online presence. It's just type it in and click the button and away you go.
So it's like schools are doing what they would normally do, but they're able to bring that work to a wider audience. Is that
exactly.
really how they're using that? Okay, so what makes it different from a regular website then is that it has to be updated more frequently.
Exactly.
Presumably. Okay.
Like, the best blogs are ones that have content every day going up on it. With schools, I've been just because I check all of what schools put up in the past couple of months. At the moment, now there's very few schools putting up anything. But during the last week before the year closes, or before the school year closes, that was a flurry of new content going up nearly every hour. So like, schools are using it, and there's about, say, 400 schools at the moment that are using blogs in some way, shape, or form.
Okay.
Yeah, it seems to me, John, that one of the barriers towards the real integration of ICT into the nuts and bolts of work in school, and you mentioned stuff that's gone on in primary, and of course it strikes me at primary that they don't have to worry, haven't had to worry for many years now, but a primary cert at the end of it all, is we have a situation in this country, do we not, where the forms of assessment that we have really haven't, you know, kept pace with the technological change around us. I mean, you can understand, can you not, a fifth year or a sixth year history teacher who says, I'm not going to bring them to the computer room very much because that's not the way they're examined. Mm-hmm. I've so much work to be doing in the conventional sense. Surely the real integration of ICT into the work, say, in post-primary schools is being hindered by the way in which we actually assess the kids.
That is true, but if you look at what the model that most schools will use for using ICT is that they bring it to the computer room. The way technology is moving now, most kids now have a mobile phone that's capable of accessing the internet. So if a teacher can change the model in the way that they're actually broadcasting or using technology and use it in a way that it suits the students with their mobile phones,
sure,
and so forth, then you can actually bring that into the assessment process as
but
well.
I mean, the fact remains that in post-primary, for example, the year during which most use is made of IT remains transition year.
Mm.
Okay, and of course, you don't have a formal state-imposed form of assessment at the end of it. Presumably, I mean, do we know, for example, with regard to the upcoming reforms of junior cycle assessment, the supposed abolition of the junior cert, is there any suggestion even there that the new forms of assessment that come in will be more receptive to incorporating ICT?
I don't know about what future subjects are going to use for assessment, but I do know that the DCG teachers have an element that they have a project which is created on a computer using SolidWorks software to create an artifact, and that's assessed. That still is kind of being examined by the SEC as a model to be followed by other subjects. I do think that the issue of security of the artifact is the most important thing, and the DCG student and teachers have a process in place.
Another thing, John, Twitter is something that we hear so much about now, and you yourself are an active tweeter. But how can Twitter be used by schools or teachers to advance their work or for educational purposes?
Yeah. Twitter is a great tool for teachers to connect. It's the best networking tool I've seen.
To connect with one another.
With one another. There are some teachers I know. There's a teacher in a school in Castlebar. I can't remember if it's St. George or St. or Davitt College, but he actually puts his homework up on it. As a business teacher, he puts his homework on it every night. So if the kids forget what homework they have, they go on Twitter and check the site, and there it is. But it's a great networking tool. Like, the amount of history teachers I'm following on Twitter is phenomenal, and you're just getting great resources. There's a guy called Russell Terr, who's a history teacher in France. He's originally from England, but he's fantastic, the resources that he comes up with. And by you can use Twitter as a search tool. Like if you type in, say, for any topic, say, French Revolution, you will find people commenting about that or linking to that, and you'll get resources back very, very quickly. It is a great tool, and it's a pity there's not more teachers on it.
Right. Yeah, and you have a lot of followers. How did you build up such an army of followers? You've up around 1,000, haven't
yeah,
you?
Yeah, it's interesting because I haven't really been concerned about my number of people I'm following or the number of people following me. But a lot of people follow people in the same interest area. Like my main area would have been in the past number of years on ed tech and on stuff like that. So basically, you kind of get the kindred spirits following each other, and then you find out who they're following, and you can follow them, and they follow you back. So it kind of creates its own culture of people following each other. Also, as well, conferences would have a hashtag, and you can follow that conference using a hashtag. And then if there's interesting people saying interesting things, you start following them. So. And if you say something interesting as well, it gets carried as well.
Gets
so
retweeted.
Exactly. And yeah. People from around the world are sharing resources with each other. And like they might be seen as virtual friends, but you're developing a relationship online, even though you've never met them face to face. But
I found it's a great way of just I've been introduced to so many new websites because of the links that are on Twitter. And I think that's probably is the single best application that I've found. Mm-hmm. Best benefit,
like from a teacher's point of view, a friend of mine who I've met a few times, Doug Belshaw, organised. He created a book for newly qualified teachers called "Move Me On," and the idea behind it was that he would get his Twitter followers to contribute one line piece of advice, and he got it published in the book, and it's now available on issue.com.
Of course, one other thing we should mention in the context of how engaged the students themselves are is boards.ie, obviously, yeah. Enough where the exam boards there, particularly the Leaving Cert board, etc., has made the news on various occasions, mm-hmm. Not least where things have gone wrong in the exams, as we've reported here. But I mean, you know, I know now, for example, it's commonplace, isn't it, in universities to have the students blogging on the even I think in some courses, certainly I know some of the masters in education courses, they have to mm-hmm. to blog as part and parcel, and there you have the students doing it sui generis at the at Leaving Cert level. So as you say, it's and certainly as regards Twitter, being on it myself, I know for a fact that the kids will find you whether you specifically intend them to or not, but they they do find you.
Okay, we're coming near the end, John. Just finally and briefly, what is your favourite ICT resource in education?
Believe it or not, it's probably one of the more simple ones. I probably have two. PowerPoint is a great tool that people really kind of say a lot of bad things about, but it's fantastic if you actually know how to use it right. But the other thing I would find most useful is an RSS reader. I would read a lot of blogs through work, and I don't know where I would be if I didn't access that every day, because just the amount of stuff I've learned from other people through blogs is unbelievable.
Okay, John, thank you very much for that, and the best of luck at Google Teacher Academy. You're the only Irish teacher attending it this year, so best of luck there. That's it for this week's programme. Until the same time next week, that's it for this week's Inside Education. I want to thank our guests John Heffernan and Barry Hennessy for the Education News. Thank you for listening.